Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, scientists may have discovered the genetic key that allowed humans to develop complex language. And new research looks deeper into what causes allergic reactions and intolerances to common foods like nuts, milk, and eggs. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Humans are unique on this earth as the only animals capable of complex speech. And new research may have identified the genetic key that might have allowed early humans to develop spoken language. Humans have a unique RNA-binding protein in their brains called NOVA1. Researchers at Rockefeller University found that when the gene was put into mice, these so-called mighty mice altered their vocalizations. I spoke with Rockefeller University's Dr. Robert Darnell to learn more.
So the gene itself is essential. It probably goes way, 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 way back in evolution. There are forms of this gene even in bacteria. They're not exactly the same. But this is an ancient gene that's an RNA regulator. And in fact, you know, just your listeners may know that it's believed by scientists now that the origin of life on the planet Earth was a membrane with RNA in it, nothing else. And the RNA had the ability to act like genetic material, because it is kind of a genetic material, and also had the ability to fold into shapes to act like a protein. So RNA was thought to be the original life molecule. And in the early, early course of evolution, when proteins were evolved, some of the earliest things that evolved were RNA binding proteins to regulate the RNA. So NOVA has lineages that go way, way back, but it became much more fixed in evolution with vertebrates, lizards, birds, mammals, and all of the mammals have the exact same form of NOVA. The gene is really unchanged in its RNA binding characteristics, all the way up through chimpanzees, you know, marmosets, different kinds of high primates. And in fact, what, you know, was discovered in 2012, which really caught our interest, was when the guy who won the Nobel Prize, Svante Paabo, sequenced the first Neanderthals and other, you know, ancient non-humans, but called hominids, like archaic versions of humans. They had the same NOVA gene. They weren't specifically looking for this, but they had the same NOVA gene that all the other mammals had, all the way down to vertebrates. And humans had a different one. So that was the first clue that, wow, this thing I've been studying for 25 years and in the clinic for 6 years before that is special in evolution. And the specialness of it was that when Paabo sequenced the Neanderthals, he found only 8 genes that seemed to be unique to humans that were different from Neanderthals, Denisovans, other, you know, Lucy, Australopithecus. All these things had all the ancient form of these 8 genes, and NOVA was one of those 8. So NOVA had something different in humans. And so that heightened our interest. Again, we weren't really initially thinking about language, but it did heighten our interest in the evolution of this, really what I thought, but I was like one of the only ones in the world interested. Nobody's ever heard of NOVA, except the TV show. But you know, the fact that it was special in humans compared to Neanderthal and Denisovan, as well as chimpanzees, that, you know, was of great interest. And Svante Paabo came out to my lab. We talked about it.
Where was the decision made then to begin seeing how it could work in other species like mice? Great.
Yeah, no, you're right on. You're following 100% my thinking, Lucas. So you're encapsulating 30 years into one interview here. But our interest was peaked in that 2012 paper showing that there were 8 genes that were special in human compared to Neanderthals, but only 8 at the time. Also the fact that we were referred, I'm a neurologist as well as a neuroscientist. So I was referred a patient who was a young boy who had, we all have two copies of every gene, mother's copy and father's copy, sperm and egg, right? So we have two copies of every gene. This boy was missing one copy. It was just deleted from his chromosomes. So he only had one NOVA1 gene, and he presented to neurologists and was referred to me. And so we actually pay for them to come to the Rockefeller, which is a little research hospital. They come, and the family was wonderful and brought this little boy along. I got to examine him and go through his records. And he actually, when he came, he had a motor dysfunction where he couldn't control his motor movements. But when he was a baby at age two, he presented to the pediatricians as like, something's not right with this kid. And the problem was language. So very specifically, he wasn't emerging with his language properly. And they get spent sent him to speech therapists. He had a diagnosis of maybe autism. So there is something called a nonverbal autism spectrum. It's part of, autism is a spectrum, and he was not doing well with his language. That actually got better with time, but then he developed this motor stuff. So interesting case. We brought him out. And he's missing one copy of NOVA1. So that really started to focus like, why don't we make a mouse model of not, we already had done a lot of mouse models where NOVA1 was lost, but let's also look at the other side of the coin. What happens in a mouse if NOVA1 is gained, the human specific variant? So we could compare sort of both ends of the spectrum. And so we made and started making, back in 2018 or so, mice that we call the Mighty Mouse. It was, a humanized, we inserted with CRISPR-Cas, inserted the human variant that was only in humans, had never been in a mammal before other than humans. We put it in a mouse and we grew colonies of mice that had, were humanized mice versus their control litter mice, which were normal mice. So we added something and then looked and looked for several years, couldn't find anything different with them. In fact, we did a lot of our, 25 years kind of biochemistry. We couldn't see any differences. It looked good in crystallography examples, and it looked good in biochemistry examples. And even if you knew, like now looking back on it, that it had a language problem, a language change, you wouldn't know an assay. You wouldn't know what to ask it. It's a mouse, it can't talk. So we were guessing, maybe it does have something to do with language. So we connected with Eric Jarvis, who's a scientist here at Rockefeller University, also a Howard Hughes investigator, top-level guy. And he had been studying songbirds for many years, how they learn to sing every spring. So he's interested in their vocalization and brain, how the brain changes in the birds, and was interested in applying that to mice and other species, his expanding his learning. So we started to do vocalization assays to ask, well, maybe there's something different about language. Like this boy who had lost the NOVA gene presented with language trouble, and the regions NOVA was expressed in could be language related. So we did language assay after language assay and came up blank. And then COVID hit and we had to lose our mouse colony. So it set us back a long ways. It's like a little bit of damage. In that case, COVID. Nowadays, I'm worried about NIH. A little bit of damage sets things back a long way. These experiments take years and years to do. So when we emerged from COVID, my postdoctoral fellow who'd been working on this had found that the humanized mouse version of NOVA and the regular mouse version were basically the same and wanted to wash your hands of this project and move on. And, I'm stubborn. You can see over the radio, I have a big nose schnoz here. I had still my own instinct, which is part of science. I was like, I really think it's worth pushing. So we resurrected those colonies and we did more assays and thought about it some more with Eric Jarvis and different kinds of vocalization assays, and boom, we hit two assays that were completely different in the mighty mouse versus their litter mates.
So you noticed that the mice were making different noises effectively, the mighty mice were actually squeaking differently or making noises differently than their control litter mates.
Well, yes, but it was a little more complicated because, as I'm saying, you know, most of the assays, they were fine. They seemed indistinguishable. So it's only when they were in certain environments when they really like were motivated to do something that they squeaked differently. So the two environments we found differences was not the average, like mice hanging out in the cage. It was when baby mice at age 8 were nursing, but they were hungry, and then the mom was brought into the cage. And the baby mice squeaked differently if they were mighty mice than regular mice. So if they had this human Nova variant in them, they were more melodic, more fluid. They, you know, we break the sort of, these are ultrasonic sounds, so it's, you can't even hear them with your ear. It has to be a recording studio like yours, but set to ultrasonic vocalizations, which is where mice squeak at. And there we could hear, basically the way Eric Jarvis breaks it down is 4 letters, like S, D, U, and M. And some of the letters were different. Some of the fluid and tone was different. And then we repeated it in a completely different assay that also worked, which was men, young men, mice, presented to a sexy lady mouse. And, you know, meaning a mouse in estrus. And the men in that scenario were like, oh yeah, the mighty mouse squeaked a lot differently, a little more musically, a little more frequently. You know, we could statistically say with 10,000 recordings that there's a big, absolute black and white difference between the mighty mouse and their litter mates right next to them. So we had solid evidence that the language sort of in the right environment was different.
Now, did it also take a mouse with the mighty mice with the Nova 1 gene to understand, if you will, the mouse who was making the noises? So does it take a mouse who has been spliced with the Nova 1 gene the ability to hear that and distinguish that for there to be communication between the mice to happen? Can a normal everyday mouse necessarily understand the different kinds of vocalizations that are made by the mighty mice?
Oh yeah. So, you know, we do have openings in the lab for this summer student rotation. So, you know, if you're interested, Lucas, this is where we're at right now. I mean, because those are the kinds of questions that we need to know. I mean, this is the first now opening in understanding not only the details of what the mice can and can't understand, but even more generally, you know, this touches on something called the theory of mind. You know, what is different if you take a chimpanzee who's very high level function, the closest animal to a human being is the chimpanzee. And, you know, back in 1978, very complicated experiments were done sort of along the lines of what you're saying. You know, what can a chimpanzee infer and what can it do about that inference, you know, seeing a man in a room with bananas hanging down and, you know, and another man in a room with the bananas hanging down, but with a stool. And they would like push a button and say, it's the guy with the stool should be the one to get the banana. And then the monkey would get a reward. You know, you could do psychological experiments in 1978 about what can a chimpanzee think compared to a human? And Noam Chomsky converted that sort of, among others, into a theory of mind that incorporated language, that the limitations on a chimpanzee included the limitations on grammar and language and being able to put thoughts into words. So that's some kind of the experiments you're thinking about. I don't know, you know, what we can find for sure with a mouse. But there's another way of looking at your question, which we will do those experiments in the mouse using modern biology. But I'm also a clinician. So, you know, the other way to think about complicated brain problems is to have nature teach us in the unfortunate cases of people who have disease. So we know, for example, like if you have a stroke in this area of your brain on the left side, the frontal motor cortex, you get what's called Broca's aphasia, where you can think of the words you want to say, but you just can't find the word, right? And there's also human neurodegenerative diseases, frontal dementias, where people are okay, but they can't find the word, the same thing, but instead of a stroke, it's degeneration of those neurons. And it gets worse and worse to the point where they can't speak at all. And that's older life, might relate to NOVA. We're looking at that. And then there's early life, like I mentioned way earlier on in the interview, of kids who have nonverbal autism. So, you know, there's developmental problems that kids have, like the ones we've seen, and we've now been referred for other kids who have mutations in NOVA who have language difficulties. So we think that we can kind of solidify our understanding of this by looking at humans who have language disease and maybe even use our knowledge about what NOVA does from our 25 years worth of data and applying that into humans in 2025 to 2030, should the NIH continue to exist, then we might be able to think about therapies.
So you may actually, in other words, be able to find solutions for humans who are having a difficulty of speaking because of the NOVA1 gene, that there could be a restoration of speech in some people, you're saying.
Correct. That's sort of, for me as a physician scientist, that's the whole point, to help people use all this knowledge. To help people. We didn't start out with language, but if language is where it's pointing us, that's where I'm going to go.
That's absolutely fascinating. Now, what about the other possibility of making other animals learn how to speak?
Well, I mean, we've done that in some sense with mice, and that already is probably necessary to have understood it this far and maybe sufficient. I think, you know. Yes, it could be done in other animals. You could imagine a seeing eye dog speaking and having value for people by saying, look out, instead of just tugging. But it also is a complicated question, too, I think. You know, I think there's ethical issues in there that I'm very conservative about. Not to say that there might not be some value to it in the case of the seeing eye dog, but that's something I think to go slow on.
Well, Dr. Darnell, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this research. It's fascinating, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lucas. It's a pleasure. Thanks for letting me talk away. I had a lot of fun.
Dr. Robert Darnell is a neuroscientist at Rockefeller University. His research is published in the journal Nature Communications. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. With common allergies and intolerances in America to foods like peanuts, eggs, and milk, scientists are seeking to understand what triggers allergic reactions. New research identifies how specific gut cells make contact with immune system cells, causing them to either tolerate, ignore, or attack certain proteins that are ingested. So how do we survive eating is the big question from Maria Cecilia Canesso, a research associate at Rockefeller University. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Dr. Canesso about food allergies, parasitic worms, and the immune system.
Common allergies are then shellfish, some like peanut is a big one, egg, milk, and it's quite common, and it's mostly developed in the beginning of life, in early life as well, which is something quite interesting, especially if you think about that this is when you are first exposed to new proteins or new substances. So when you see that, you should tolerate. That's what a normal immune response would be, if you think about it. But sometimes you don't. And then you create an immune response, you have these inflammatory reactions to food antigens, and these big ones are like the most allergens, let's put them that way. That's how we call them.
And in your research, you looked at the specific cells that basically are the cells that cause these reactions or intolerances and allergies. So can you just tell me what cells that you researched and what roles do they play?
first of all, we started to look into this, which cells are playing a role in here, especially under this antigen-presenting cells or APCs. So these are the cells of the immune system that will actually see this new antigen or substances of protein particles, pick them up and show or present to other cells that will actually induce a tolerogenic or an inflammatory response. So you can really think of these APCs as decision-making cells. So we decided to look at them and see which ones are presenting dietary antigens when you have a tolerogenic or when you tolerate food you eat and you're all good with that, or when you have an inflammatory response to food antigens. So to sort of like answer this question, to understand, to pinpoint exactly which cells are doing what, we took advantage of this new technology that we developed in the lab that it's called Lipstick, where we can actually fish out which cells are presenting a specific dietary antigen. And you can track that cell, those cells to see who are they when they are inducing tolerance or inflammation. Then we found that mostly tolerance to food is induced by two different subsets of antigen-presenting cells, which are called dendritic cells, classic dendritic cells type 1, as well as ROR gamma T expressing APCs or antigen-presenting cells. So those two are involved on food, inducing food tolerance. And on the other side of it, when you don't have tolerance to food anymore, and we used a worm infection, a parasitic infection, which is the Strongyloides venezuelensis, when you are infected with that worm, you don't induce tolerance to food anymore. So you don't have food allergy development, and that's very important, but you don't have the tolerance to food being developed. So we use that model to understand now what happened with those tolerogenic APCs when you have an infection that don't induce tolerance anymore. And then we found that pretty much the another subset of antigen-presenting cells called classic dendritic cells type 2, one specific subset of them, they are responding to the worm. So they are inducing the inflammatory response to the worm infection. And there is a lot of them being induced when you have the infection. And that outnumbers the tolerogenic APCs that now don't have the chance to present dietary antigens anymore. And that's how you don't have the tolerance to food being induced when you have this kind of worm infection.
The immune system is important when it comes to allergies and intolerances. So what role does the immune system play in all this?
Exactly. So the immune system is the one that will recognize or see this food as a friend or foe, pretty much. Is this a good thing? Should I tolerate it? And then, you know, we're not going to create an inflammatory response. We're fine. You can eat. You're not going to feel anything. Or on the other way around, is it, it's not, or is an infection. The immune system is the one that responds to any infection as well, or in the case of food allergy. So that will tell you, this is not good. We need to create an inflammatory response to either remove the pathogen, to kill the pathogen, or to get rid of the toxin in the food allergy or something like that. So that could go from diarrhea, fever, inflammation, all of that. It's based on the immune system recognizing those specific antigens as good or bad, and how to, if it's bad, how to get rid of it, basically.
And with all this in mind, what you've just told me, with your research, how does all of this give more insight into food allergies?
Right. So as I said, the worm infection doesn't really induce food allergy. It just shifts the tolerogenic response. So the tolerogenic antigen-presenting cells are not playing a role anymore. So you don't have a tolerance to food, but and it's shift basically to an inflammation to the worm, but not inflammation to food. So I think moving on in the future, if food allergy is also induced or is caused also by this shift away from the tolerogenic APCs and getting into the inflammatory APCs, which could be the similar to the ones inducing an immune response to the worm, since the type of immune response you have, what we call Th2, is the same for allergy and for worm infections. If that's true, then we could then start to modulating these cells or trying to target these specific antigen-presenting cells, either the tolerogenic to induce tolerance to on allergic people, or the allergic or inflammatory APCs to avoid or to prevent an anaphylaxis response or more inflammatory response. So I think that's where we wanted to move next. How does these cells play a role in food allergy? And is this how food allergy is induced, and how can we modulate that?
And then my last question to you is, what are you excited about researching further into this topic in regards to allergies and intolerances?
Yeah. So for me, I'm very interested in study early life, because if you think about, as we were talking, we touched a little bit on it before, most food allergies are induced in early life. And this is the time that you are mostly exposed to new proteins, to new kind of food. So what I wanted to study in the future, moving on, is maternal neonatal immunity and how breast milk and antigens presenting breast milk and the maternal status, diet, maternal infections and things like that while you're breastfeeding. How does that affect antigen composition and non-antigen composition as well? Things in the breast milk that will affect probability of the offspring to develop food allergy or not. So I think this is a moment of life. It's such an important, you know, window that you have a different immune system than when you are an adult, and you are exposed to all of these different antigens, and we do develop most food allergies at that time of life. So why and how can we modulate that?
Dr. Maria Cecilia Canesso is a researcher at Rockefeller University. Her study into food allergies is published in the journal Science. She spoke with Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1796. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.